why you have that approval?
Well, there are many reasons that I buy it. I think the primary one is that I perceive that it is a, an accommodation to friends.
Well, I think it would be important to get if you think of it as a friends. You don't feel the scale is not a real sale. It's more like a favor, like, can you do this to me? I'll go back to you afterwards. Because if you can make money out of it, then you owe you why you have that approval.
Well, there are many reasons that I buy it. I think the primary one is that I perceive that it is a, an accommodation to friends.
Well, I think it would be important to get if you think of it as a friends. You don't feel the scale is not a real sale. It's more like a favor, like, can you do this to me? I'll go back to you afterwards.
Well, I think that I can understand where your question originates, but no, in my mind, it has always been a real sale, as real as any business transaction I've ever done. In my mind and in my contracts, I own this product. It's mine. I intend to buy it. I intend to buy it for value. And I feel and believe that I own it. It's mine. I can do with it what I want. And whether or not I paid an outstanding debt that relates to the sale does not impact my clear title to this property. Mine, I can do what I want with it. I do not view it as being a sham. I do view it as being a real transaction, as much so as if I called my broker and said at the market buy, and he sent me a confirmation, and 3 days later I sent him a check. Does that answer?
Yes.
Part of the sale is, of course, a rental storage area where the stomach is found. In your estimation, what do you approximate the value of that storage area?
Well, it depends upon whose storage area. Some people will seal off a closet or a cabinet or a room or a storage facility or a house or a mansion or a warehouse. It depends upon the space.
In an average home where the cabinet is being sold, what would you assume fair market value for a period of 10 days or so might be?
The fair rental
value?
Well, here again, it relates to the property very much. Is it a cabinet in the home of a gentleman on 247th Street whose kitchen cost $275,000, or is it a cabinet in a more traditional apartment house on Johnson Avenue, which was put in by a builder at a cost of $300 for the whole kitchen? I think that has to be the answer. There is a value. The value could be determined through comparison of spaces and comparison of market rents and quantifying it down to that amount of cubic content. It could be done. I have not done that, but it could be done.
Any questions
asked
both of you? In terms of the rental of the property, is it the full rental of the property for all uses to live there, or is it just the rental for storing various items?
Let me speak first. It's hard to live in a cabinet. See, Mr. Brown is a strapping gentleman. For a crawl space.
In general, I think that what we are doing is we
leasing a premise. And by virtue of this particular facet of transferring title to the property, as I understand Jewish law, if you take title to or have a leasehold on a piece of real estate, by virtue and by operation of law, you also take title to and own all of the chattels in that real estate.
Right, I'm just saying in terms of the rental itself, you could rent something for general all purposes to live there as well, but you can also rent something for a specific purpose. I'm renting it just that you, for example, many places have storage space available. So they're not going to move in or leaving their storage space. They're renting this area specifically for a rent space in Bangalore. You're renting it for the specific use of using that ball box. If you want to take out the ball box and put something else in there, you couldn't do that. What we're asking here is an all-purpose rental of the situation of a room or a house. Would you guys just go in one day and study, eat your breakfast and lunch, or other be able to conduct your business in there, or is it just a storage?
I think that the contractual arrangement that I have with the people who I'm doing business with is as follows, and
we'll pull out the document and see what it says. Okay. He hasn't seen a document for you saw it yesterday. He hasn't seen his document since last April.
It is my intention, and I think it is the intention of the contract, to lease me a space. Now, that space may be a cabinet, maybe a closet, maybe a kitchen, maybe a store, maybe a whole house. Whatever the individual intention is in the individual contract, that is what I am contracting to do. Now, it is understood, and I believe it is written in the contract. It certainly is articulated by the various rabbis who act as agents to these people, that I shall have the uninhibited right to go to this closet, room, house, warehouse, and have free access to it in order to remove my personal property if I choose to do so.
That is true. Indeed, I may read from the documents, and Mr. Brown almost has it down to the word. It is further agreed that the buyer shall have the right to access to the premises of the sellers in each of them in order to gain access to the respective storage areas here and above described. So it's clear, let's say even, for example, if Mr. Brown rents out an inner room, and I rent out, and I own all the outer rooms. Do you want to tell me the word is easement? You want to use some other real estate term for that.
A constructive easement.
Right. In other words, you can own a property. There's someone I don't own in Riverdale, Delafield there that I know about, who owned the property which is behind someone else's house, used to act as Henry Hudson, but now they built it up, and he has to go to someone else's property, and they made some kind of an arrangement.
Right away.
Right. So at the very least, that's what he has. To answer your question a little more carefully, I think it's important to see that in the previous paragraph, that the agent leases, on behalf of the seller, leases to the buyer closets, cabinets, storage rooms, garages, basements, where the chametz may be located. Now, it doesn't specifically say in the contract that it's leasing for a particular purpose. So I believe that the contract reads on its face that the lease is a complete lease. And therefore, I think that certainly if Mr. Brown would want to, I guess in a smaller area, if it's just a cabinet, you really couldn't eat your breakfast there. But if there would be a room which, or an entire house, then Mr. Brown could eat his breakfast there. I should add, and this is a very important point, that I will read the next sentence of the previous paragraph. In the event that the buyer shall require keys to gain access to any of the premises described herein, it shall be made available to him upon demand to the agent. Now this divides into two things. If either the party is at home during the Passover holiday, which is the majority of the individuals who have make me their agent, in which case, Mr. Brown would just knock on the door and say, I'm Mr. Brown, I have the paper to prove it, Mr. Brown. If you don't believe it, you can call the rabbi who was your agent, whether it be myself, or Rabbi Rosenblatt, or Rabbi Weiss, or Rabbi Cohen, or whoever it may have been, and they will verify that I am in fact Mr. Brown. And then, if this particular room, which was rented to me, then not only have to let me get the chametz out, you have to let me stay there, within reason. Because after all, it's pointed out over here that, as in any other such understanding, since these people don't know Mr. Brown that well, they may not want to leave Mr. Brown unattended in their house for a long period of time. They may walk around with all their silver. All right? So, they're not required to do that. So they have to accommodate him, he has to accommodate them, and there's a piece of reasonableness. It's probably the best way to describe what should transpire. Should Mr. Brown desire to spend some time in the area which he has rented. And for the fact, Mr. Brown has chosen on his own not to take physical possession of the chametz, and I believe he's also chosen on his own not to knock on the door and say, you know, I need a place for my breakfast. I believe it's because Mr. Brown has a place for his breakfast, and in terms of his not desiring to claim the physical chametz, I won't speak for him, but I'll just, my guess would be that thank God he has his own chametz, and I don't know if he wants to get involved in the hassle of what we call the fair market value determined by three recognized experts, and it could be a little bit of a hassle. And since he has explained to us, he's doing this as an accommodation to for his friends, and we're happy that we are his friends and he is our friend, he feels that, you know, if the accommodation to the friend is that he owns it, and he owns it completely, as he told Josh before, there's no need for him to go into someone's house and take the bottle of liquor or the box of cookies, because he has his own liquor and his own cookies. But if I have no doubt that Mr. Brown would run short of liquor, and the liquor stores will be closed for a weekend or something of this nature, and he'd want to have some customer come to his office and drink liquor, there's no doubt in my mind he has the files in his office. He'd look it up and say, let's see which one is a good one. And he would come in and take it.
I would not hesitate.
That's right. Josh?
Yeah. Just the answer to the question you gave me before about assess the value of more storage or building.
Yeah.
The answer is assess the value of each storage property. That would really kill the idea of one cent per
person. Right. As I told you before, in your absence, John, yesterday, I explained to them, that was basically Mr. Rothman's question before. When it comes to the value of the chametz itself, we have 1 cent per person in the report right now. The rest is on or before the last day of Passover. And they have the balance due is a debt from buyer to seller, the non-payment of which shall no way affect the buyer's power of the chametz sold. Okay, that's what we explained. Now, that's as far as the chametz itself. As far as the rental is concerned, we say, in consideration for the foregoing rental provision, the buyer agrees and hereby does pay to the agent the sum of 1 cent for each of the enumerated sellers. Now, we have a book here, a Hebrew language book, which says, they're not so happy with that. Because after all, the rental itself, the property to be rented for 10 days, might be more than 1 cent. Maybe it's 10 cents, maybe it's $10, maybe it's more, maybe it's less. So my response was that although it's true, as you said before in your answer to this question, well, there may be a way of evaluating how much this really is worth. Is it really worth a cent? Maybe less than a cent? Because, you know, what's it worth? Who's going to pay you even 1 cent to have a storage right to a cabinet in someone else's house and you have to get the key each time you need it? I was afraid it was worth less than a cent, frankly. On the other hand, the whole warehouse, you know, even though even with these restraints, it might be worth them to you if you're willing to then go ahead and find someone who wants to store something. You know, that's not much with the store, because it's filled with chametz. Right? If he wants to store something in the aisle somewhere, for 10 days, he'll pay for it. That's not an easy, it's not an easy market. The proof is Mr. Brown hasn't entered into that market. He has all the markets covered. This market of renting storage space for 10 days, even your lesser colleagues haven't entered that market yet, to my knowledge.
I think it's an untouched market.
For good reason, I think. That's why I write the 1 cent, and I think it's better to be left that way.
If you decided to go into someone's house, not take any chametz, just sit there, would you also have to get three experts to decide if he spent a day in the person's house?
No, that's the penny covers it. He doesn't have to pay anything for that. He can sit there, there's no problem. John, you want to come into my house? Well, my house, you have just a little bit of a...
Thanks.
You can stay in my living room. I have no problem. I didn't rent it to you. Spend the whole day there. No problem.
No, so someone who goes away.
Oh, rents the entire home.
He rents the entire home.
So and then say Mr. Brown comes.
He can live there for 8 days without touching anything.
Right. So let's say. So listen. Let's figure this out. So let's say Mr. Brown would go. So we have some individuals who sell their homes and go to a different country. Mr. Brown mentioned a particular address, a particular street, where a particular individual is on that street who usually goes to Israel for Passover holiday. And let's say Mr. Brown decide that he really wants to spend some time there. It's a very beautiful house. And it's, you know, he wants to spend some time there. Of course, he'd come and knock on the door and probably find nobody home. Let's give him some help to do it. Like nobody home. But he knows where I live. I'm home for the past while. He'd come to my house and, you know, I have a problem. You know, let's say my car broke down and I can't get back to up north where I live. It's about this, about an hour from New York or something.
Putnam County,
about an hour from New York. And I really decided that I'm going to stay this evening. I'd like to stay in Riverdale. And, you know, I rented this house on 247th Street, and I think there's a room for me to stay, and I would like to stay there. Mr. Brown would do that. What I would do is find somebody, probably someone from my family, to stay with him, because, you know, I think the person on 247th, although he's done a lot of business with Mr. Brown, and I think he trusts Mr. Brown completely, nevertheless, as a matter of policy, we'd want to have someone else in, staying there together with Mr. Brown. So I'd probably send one of my sons, who also known Mr. Brown for many years, and they could maybe watch some TV together. I don't know what they would do there in the house, because I think they can't do it in my house. And if Mr. Brown, before bedtime, decided to have some liquor, so my son would just simply record what Mr. Brown had taken. He certainly could take it, it's his, and say, okay, he took a bottle of Chivas Regal, is that what it's called? Is that the good stuff?
That's what it's called.
And he'd write it down, and then the next day they'd go out, and my son would lock the door, and he'd give me back the key. And when Passover would be over, and the gentleman would come back, and said, who's been sleeping in this bed? So we would tell him, and say, wait a minute, let me go down to my, where I'm missing a bottle. Yes, you're missing a bottle. And they would go to the market value, go to the liquor, Skyview Liquor, or maybe liquor, whatever, and say, how much is this bottle worth? And they'll say it's $20, I don't know what it's for, whatever it's worth. And Mr. Brown was simply, undoubtedly make good on his debt. I mean, there's no question in my mind that the $20 will be paid.
Just a pen.
Well, let me answer first, and Mr. Brown, who knows the field better than me, can answer later. I have claimed, and that was my class we discussed yesterday, that even there's a sentence which is as follows. In the event that any of the sellers may be tenants of the premise they presently occupy, with respect to such sellers, this provision shall be intended to convey a sublease of the areas where such chametz may be located. In this book, same Hebrew language book, he raises an issue which we've raised before, I believe, in the past, and that is that many people have a no sublease clause in their own lease. I rent an apartment on Johnson Avenue, and it says there, I sign a piece of paper that the tenant will not sublease the apartment without the specific approval of the landlord. And here, the tenant from Johnson Avenue goes ahead and sublists it to John Brown without getting permission from the landlord. So he recommends, go to your landlord. And I've told people not to go to the landlord because it's going to, again, not the landlord wouldn't approve. If he knew what it was, he would certainly approve. But you know, red tape, bureaucracy. You call up you get some kind of mean-spirited secretary who transfers to us a mean-spirited middle management person. So you get to the front of the top guy who's like, oh, you're selling the chametz. No problem. But you know, you need to go through with the red tape. So I'm convinced that there's no fair-minded, but even not fair-minded, landlord who would object to the sale and rental as done, as we've been doing it for all these years. So I don't feel it's necessary to ask. Now, what do you say, Mr. Brown?
Well, as a practical matter, where there is a prohibition against subletting, in order for that prohibition to trigger any kind of sanctions, the landlord has to be aware of it. The sublease is not invalidated by operation of this prohibition in the prime lease. So the fact that somebody leases me something in contravention of his agreement with his landlord doesn't affect the validity of the sublease. It's a good sublease. If the landlord discovers it, and he is that mean-spirited person who wants to interfere with it, he's free to do so. But by the time he got the wheels moving, he'd be looking at the next Passover.
That's what I said. I said the court will say in 10 days it has to be undone.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
do it, if you do it, I don't understand why it would make a difference. If it doesn't know about it, it might contractually valid for you and that guy, but meanwhile, the other guy's going to the guy with some of those comments is doing something illegal.
Well, I think you need to make a distinction between something that's illegal in the criminal sense, as this is, and something which is in contravention of a prior agreement.
Well, I don't understand if the guy doesn't know about it. I don't understand why that should affect, even if he doesn't know about it, it still should affect any sales you make.
Let me answer that question. So it wasn't clear. My estimation is that if he would know about it, and I say know about it, I mean know about it completely, with all the ramifications and all the details and all the history, that he wouldn't object to it whatsoever.
I know my parents were going as being arrived there. My parents were going to look for an apartment for the time. And the people who were going to sublet from other people, they had to secret us into the apartment building and then show us the apartment quickly, and then the landlord was checking around. He doesn't want anyone subletting in the apartments. They're paranoid. They're going to sublet apartments, and they're going to make money off. They're going to lose out money from their apartments. I mean, these guys are really paranoid. They don't want to lose their real estate markets down. They don't want to lose their business. If they even hear about any, utter the term sublet to them, no matter how small the space is, they're going to automatically trigger off paranoia in their minds. And they're going to,
you're exactly right. You're exactly right. That's exactly why I counsel to these people: don't call up the word and mention that parrot, the word which will trigger the paranoia. Do nothing. And in my opinion, it's not illegal, because illegal means as follows: if I do something, it's something we call that stealing. If I steal from you, that's something which is illegal. As we learned in our previous years, when we studied over here, the contractate, it's only considered to be illegal and considered to be theft if we can assume that you are particular and you refuse to allow permission for this. We call it in Hebrew to makpid. You don't want to allow it to happen. But if we can estimate that the likely is, that in all likelihood, all probability, you wouldn't object, then I'm not considered a thief if I take something of yours or use something of yours. And this is something which is assumed all the time. For example, in Jewish law, if you see somebody's a talis at the prayer shawl, and you forgot yours at home, you may use that prayer shawl, provided, of course, you fold it up neatly after you finish. Why? Because we assume that the average person wouldn't mind if someone else used that prayer shawl, because he wants that others should be able to perform a mitzvah, a positive commandment, with his property. That's what the Talmud teaches us. So that's just an example of a more general rule, which is that we have to creep into someone's mind and figure, what would he really, if he knew this story, would he object to that? This doesn't stop an individual who say, I don't care, I, as a matter of principle, I'm going to fight it, and I'm going to step to it. Okay, that's true, that's a possibility. But I don't believe that we are required by Jewish law to worry about that possibility. It's so remote.
The problem is that we may not be required by Jewish law. We're operating between different roles, between different sects of law.
The
whole different story. I understand the idea of
a prayer show, but I spoke to an attorney. That's a good point. I spoke to an attorney who told me that in his professional considered opinion, even according to American law, a sublease which is of this nature would not be considered by a court of law, if it came to it, to be a violation of the lease. So ultimately, he thinks the landlord would lose anyway if it came to if it would be taken to the ultimate court of law. That's what my attorney thought.
I think that is probably the most important thing. If you execute a document which releases a premise, but there is no physical possession, I don't think that a landlord could demonstrate that he was in any way hurt, and therefore he could not get the courts to enforce this prohibition.
But if Mr. Brown...
If I took possession...
And he'd sit there for 10 days and pay the penny, then maybe. But even so, I'm not sure. I'm still not sure. But it's only a penny. So they're afraid they're going to make a lot of money over the payment. One penny. Yeah, but yeah. So it is a paranoia. So because of that reason, we just sort of let it go. Yes?
Yeah, it's a quality of the contract, but that's so recent. The last
stop the sublease once you find out about it. But the whole sublease is good in and of itself.
That's the point. So therefore,
it's a good sale the whole time. It's a very
exactly.
Absolutely right.
No,
that's the way I view it.
That's what I think too. Yeah. No.
Do you have any problems with, let's say, a half a box of macaroni or something like that?
In terms of what am I going to do with a half a box of macaroni?
No problem. You cook it.
I don't have any trouble with that at all. None whatsoever. What I am taking possession of is physical property in a location in various containers. If it happens to be in a glass jar or a box that's half full, it's of no consequence.
Are there more questions? Yes.
You mentioned before there was a question in terms of sort of being paid to stay or you even answered that you were accommodating friends. It seems to me that you've been doing this for almost 20 years now. You know every single time the sale goes through a few days before Passover that in 10 days from now you're going to hand it back. Doesn't it seem
he's going to be selling it back.
Right. Doesn't it seem, you had said also that you don't look at this as any different than any other type of sale that you might make for any guy who has a transaction right there. Doesn't it seem a little strange that you're doing it every single year, you know exactly what's going to happen, and 10 days from now you're going to sell it back? How do you call that a regular type of business deal?
Well, let me answer you by saying first that what I tried to convey was not that this was exactly the same as every other commercial transaction I get involved in. What I was trying to convey to you was that in my mind, the quality of the title to these goods is no less enforceable than the quality of the title of the house I own. I bought it for value, it's mine, it's my intention that it be mine. Now to address your other question, your prime question, none of us know what tomorrow holds. None of us have a crystal ball. We can make guesses, we can make estimates. We buy food for next week in the hopes that we'll be alive next week, but none of us know what's going to happen. And one of the rabbis occasionally brings me a bottle of shivas and says, would I personally destroy this? Which I'm happy to do.
How long does it take you, John, to destroy that?
Sometimes it takes me a couple of days.
As long as you come back sober 10 days later. Once Mr. Brown was late, once, I think it was with your wife went eating out, came a few minutes late, that's all, the whole neighborhood was trembling.
Getting back to your question, I don't know what's going to happen. I can't promise you that I'll get back to my office alive today, and I can't promise myself that at the end of the holiday period, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. I don't know what I'm going to do. It so happens that for the last 18, 20 years, I've done what you just recounted, but that doesn't mean I'm going to do it this year.
I want to add one point, which I think we once made in one of our classes, or maybe it was Mr. Brown. There are individuals. Now, I guess we have a business school. Our business school students will be more expert than myself. There are apparently, and this is relevant, this is what we call the Yon of the Yom. It's a December phenomenon. Apparently, there are people who do something called a rollover, which means, I don't know exactly what it means, but it means that because of tax reasons, they transfer things from one ownership, one title, to another over the January 1st, and then they transfer it back on January 2nd. I don't know what I'm talking about exactly, but I know something of this nature, and it has some impact on taxes. Now, they may have been doing it for the last 20 years, but for those 3 days, a different corporate entity or personal entity, as it may be, really owned the possessions. Is there any truth to what I just said in the business world? Does that make any sense?
Selling against the box. You sell stock at the end of the year, mm-hmm. that you have, but you sell it short and replace it with the stock you already have.
whatever it is. See, I told you, they're taxing. But these taxings, it's bona fide. It's real. You may be doing it for some reason. Same thing, Mr. Brown. You may be doing it as an accommodation for us, but it's real. And it has the same way as this deal is real. Yes?
Maybe Elliot's problem is that, you know, rollover, wherever it is, I'm suing, there's no prohibition of making the first sale if you intend to buy it back 3 years later.
Mm-hmm.
But with us, there is.
No, there is.
Inherent problem.
Absolutely not. Even though we know that Mr. Brown's track record, and our track record is, that after the holiday is over, he will sell these goods back to us. Nevertheless, since during the Passover holiday itself, it belonged to Mr. Brown, and there was no guarantee of what was going to happen in the future, we may tell him that, you know, as an accommodation to him, that should he decide, he doesn't want to bother with all the estimations and all the taking the possession, he wants to sell it back to us, that we'll accommodate him. But nevertheless, as he said before, we don't know what he's going to do. We just don't know. Yes?
Well, both purchase and resale acts of the rabbi occurred
with you physically present there.
Yes.
Oh, for sure.
In other words, you travel from the state later
on
Wednesday
to
Passover. Well, let's say it's, for example, a weekend. You personally come back in to the sale back in New York.
Yes, that's right. Brown has been very, very accommodating. No question about it. This year. Yeah, this year. We have a new wrinkle this year, John. Passover begins on a Sunday. It happens, you know, some years. That, of course, goes the monkey wrench in, because usually, you know, we have the 8 days of the holiday. We do usually two transactions. One the morning, Passover Eve in the morning, and one is the afternoon before that. And this year, of course, both the evening and the afternoon, the morning of Passover Eve is a Saturday morning. Passover is on Sunday. We can't do business on Saturday. We have to do business on Friday. We may even do a Thursday afternoon business because of those individuals who were going away and don't want to sell, don't want to check their houses. We discussed this in our other class. I want to say before I forget that Mr. Brown, I still owe a debt of gratitude to him. About 15 years ago, you're not going to believe this, it was a snowy, you're probably too young to remember this, maybe some of the older members may remember, it's looking around that time, it snowed on the day of before Passover. And in that day, of all things, our Eruv fell down. That's the air which surrounds the Rivendell area, which enables us to carry in, you know, baby carriages on the Sabbath, on Saturday. And I was sitting there, and I'm not two left hands, and there's a Passover tonight, and I just discovered the fence came down, and well, Mr. Brown helped me out. He went, I think, to a hardware store, got some wire, and he helped me tie it on. He helped me. I watched him tie it on. So
we got a close stuff.
Yeah, it worked and it stayed for as long as we needed it till we had more last to prepare for the holiday. So we've had a lot of experiences together over the years. Yes, ma'am.
One more question. It's really a little bit more of a topic, but it came up. I think you mentioned that stuff is not criminally illegal. I was not sure if you're saying it's nothing illegal, it's just it's not for trip down. The shirt is going away for the summer. He doesn't want his home to be vacant. For something to some people to maintain a home. Now, is such an action illegal? And I'm assuming the owner will, the landlord will not find out about it. But it will definitely have to be enforced. And that person will have to come to court. Has something illegal been done?
Well, my problem with answering your question is I'm not sure what is an appropriate definition of what's legal and illegal in this context where we sit. As a practical matter, I don't think it's an illegal action. I think that an action has been taken that's in contravention of a contractual obligation. The person who perceives that he has been hurt has options. He has remedies. His options are to enforce his remedy or not to enforce his remedy. I don't think this is illegal. If I contract with you to buy a property from you, and you contract with me to sell it in appropriate form, consideration, whatever, and partway through that agreement, I announce to you that I repudiate the agreement. I haven't done anything illegal in my sense, though. I've done something immoral. I've done something improper, you have remedies. You can sue me for specific performance. But I don't think I've done anything illegal. Do you?
This may be worse, Mr. Brown. I'll tell you why this is a little worse in your case. Because in your case, you reneged. In this case, since the property belonged to the landlord, his house, you are using his property in a way which is in which he didn't agree to have it used. So it's a little bit different than your case. So let's leave it at that. That's a complicated question. Let's stick to the topic, okay? Because it's not fair. Yeah.
With this agreement, even though it may not be illegal, can the landlord say today, right now, that that throw you out of the house because you violated the contract?
I don't think that that's a remedy that's available or enforceable. I think the landlord's only remedy.
You would say in the bottom of the contract.
I don't think a clause.
Any violation in this within this anyone violating any clause within this contract is immediate grounds for removal from premises.
It could say that in the contract.
So,
and
it violates
the court would enforce it.
So now within 10 days.
It's analogous to a cancellation of a commercial lease for bankruptcy of the tenant. Courts won't enforce it. Guy goes into bankruptcy, the court says that's against public policy.
One of the terms of the contract is that the risk of loss is transferred to the buyer. Yourself, you owe the funds which is purchased. The risk of loss is now placed on the buyer. Your understanding of that clause is that a factory or warehouse should burn down and come into sold, the risk of loss will be borne by you.
I am afraid that that is a risk that I have to live with.
I want to add before Mr. Brown goes further that I have interjected in that discussion that my understanding is, and I could be wrong if I ask experts, is that an insurance policy, which is certainly exists in any major situation, would honor a claim. Now, I've been told that maybe not. The insurance policy is always looking to get out. And they'll say, what do you mean? We only made a deal with this particular gentleman or this particular corporation. And we have reason to understand that during this particular time of the fire that someone else owned it. We never made a deal with him. What would the outcome be in the court of law on that is, to my mind, certainly questionable. And certainly the insurance company might just, be willing to pay it out and start to have a whole... They won't win hands down, put it that way. So that's why I think that although Mr. Brown is a magnanimous in saying he's taking a risk, I think the risk is somewhat lessened. I also mentioned something which we once spoke about. I forget the context, Mr. Brown. And I want to bring it up because we wanted to no hold barred here in the discussion. We were discussing that one of the great rabbis of 180 years ago, Rabbi Sofer from Pressburg in Czechoslovakia, he wrote two documents. One document which he gave to the non-Jew, and one document which he gave to, which he kept for himself, both of signed by both parties. And I mentioned to the student that I don't do that, that I give the copy, there's only one copy that's given to you. And one of the reasons, in one of our conversations over the years, and I forget the exact context, a discussion was had about such an eventuality, and maybe you'll remember how it came out, that if such a thing would transpire, and Chumas would burn down, that of course Mr. Brown bears the risk of the loss, of the loss of value, if it went down in value, etc. At the same time, for us to take Mr. Brown to court would not be an easy matter either. Now, we respect Mr. Brown's integrity, but integrity is one thing, and we have $1 billion worth of stuff in a van worth to put away, that's another thing. We would not have an easy time winning the case in court because all the documentation is in Mr. Brown's office. And, that office is not so secure. I mean, and if suddenly all the papers would vanish, you have a difficult time proving too much. Although we trust each other completely. But again, at the risk is all the risk. Because certainly, you heard that he spoke first. He accepted the risk. But at the same time, that's the last thing. One of our conversations came up.
Well, I do remember it.
Yeah. I don't remember how, whether you brought it up or I brought it up or someone else, third party brought it up.
Someone pointed out the fact that
the papers are by you.
Exactly.
Josh? You know how long it takes to move with an insurance company, Josh? You know, it's just, it really is a...
Why, you have to sell it through the insurance company?
No, it's red tape, and it's just...
Transferring...
We pray for Mr. Brown's good health, and secondarily, we pray for the good health of this warehouse in Hunts Point that no one should set it ablaze. So far, we've been very fortunate and blessed on both counts. Okay. If there are no more questions, I want to just go through what we call the mock sale, and we have the documents here that we use this year with one of our students who happens not to be here today. We typed it on his word processor. It would be a little more when I get it finally. It's just, you know, my lawyer, always lawyers. My lawyer met me today in the synagogue. He wants to change something. Already something no good. Somewhere in here, here it is. I use an expression. You have these before in front of you?
Yeah.
Now, therefore, it is agreed by and between the agent as attorney in fact for the sellers. So my lawyer, I just faxed it to him yesterday. So this morning in the synagogue, I told him, that's no good. I want to take the word attorney in fact out.
Why?
Because attorney in fact means notarized. It's power of attorney notarized. Since we don't notarize it, so then maybe the whole thing is not exactly the way it's supposed to be. And someone's going to make a quibble that's not really representing the real facts. So probably have to change the agents instead of, see, there's no limit to change. I'm sure after we finish all the changes this year, someone can make more changes next year. Why not? I don't think these changes, these things that are ruining the entire effectiveness of the document. But still, there's always room for more, yes?
Wouldn't it be better now to leave this? Because why? As a binding agreement, initially the court would say, well, Rabbi Willing and Mr. Brown thought this was a good contract, but now let's say, fire would occur, the catastrophe would occur. So Mr. Brown would say, well, yes, I agree, but just looking back, I realize that now there's a minor technicality.
We don't want to do that at all. No, that's no good, because then if it turns out the Chametz, if this ends up being no good, then the Chametz is owned in retrospect by Mr. Weinberg, as it happens to be. We don't want that to happen. So we want that Mr. Brown should own it completely. We want it to be completely good. Okay? So we've basically gone through, and now we're going to have a mock sale. Do we have any chametz here? Do we have any cookies or something? No one brought anything? Ask them who's the... Alright. There we go. This is real chametz. Okay. So here we have some bread, which I want to sell to Mr. Brown. So we will now try to, as best as we can, recreate... Mr. Brown didn't have to tell him with the bank this morning. I didn't ask him to. But he may have a quarter in his pocket or a penny, whatever he may have. So if this would be what we were doing.
It's a quarter.
I'll let you work.
That's why we prefer the company
sell their comments to you, and they want to do it in many different ways. And we explain, as the document does as well, that we do it many different ways because we're not exactly sure which way it works. There's so many different ways that have been advanced by the rabbis and their codes of law, we're not sure that maybe this works, maybe that works. We try to do as many of them as we can. Of course, in this case, we'll be able to do one more, but the Brown can actually take physical possession, which he can't do on Passover Eve because there's so much of it spread out, he can't take it all. Sell chametz to a pauper. It's ridiculous. He can't pay the money. He should sell chametz to someone who has more money. So that's why we sell to John Brown, because he has enough money to pay, I hope. That's also, if you can find it in the safe, please let me know. I can't relocate it. Somewhere there. It's a problem.
Traditionally, they sell a lot of time.
the soup for the janitor. Yes, terrible, terrible. The consultant is the problem. Kenyan Agav is the Rabban. According to many, many, we've shown them Kenyan Agav is the Rabban. And that shouldn't work for a Dorais. So the Chasam Sofer says what I told you yesterday, as Mechav and I own the Chasam Sofer. The Chasam Sofer says that, no. When do we say that Kenyan Rabban doesn't work for Dorais? So with the Dorais, you need ownership in a positive way. By Lulav, Lachem B'Yamarishim. The problem. The soup for the janitor. Yes, terrible, terrible. The sulfur is the problem. Kenyan Agav is the Rabban. According to many, many, we've shown them Kenyan Agav is the Rabban. And that shouldn't work for a Dorais. So the Chasam Sofer says what I told you yesterday, as Mechav and I own the Chasam Sofer. The Chasam Sofer says that, no. When do we say that Kenyan Rabban doesn't work for Dorais? So with the Dorais, you need ownership in a positive way. By Lulav, Lachem B'Yamarishim. But over here, it's enough that you don't own the Chumas. That Kenyan Rabban for sure works with the Raisa. Because what's the shadow of Kenyan Rabban for the Raisa? Does Hefka Bezen have to own the power to expropriate or even to appropriate? That's the shadow, that's a very legitimate question. But over here, for Chumas, it's enough to expropriate. For the Raisa, as long as the Chumas belongs to the Jew, even if it goes to what I call the no man land, goes to Hefka. Good enough. So therefore, what I told you yesterday is the Chasam Sofer. The Chasam Sofer says so. Now, so we use Kenyan Agav. We use Kenyan Agav. The problem is,
did you use Kenyan Agav the first year?
Always use Kenyan Agav, even before John Brown. But it was the truth of the matter. I don't think she understood it from the first woman that we used to sell to. I don't know. I had a consultant, is another issue, which I asked this consultant.
What does Chasam Sofer say?
The bottom of the down to the right is if you need a positive ownership, like Lulu, the Kakam Lachem. But the comments of Chomet is a negative, as long as you don't own it.
Why
is it for the rest of it? Huh? First, even without Bittl. Even if it wouldn't be for Bittl, Yaakov. Let's say I sell the Chomet to the Kenyan Agav. So on the right level, we say the Kenyan didn't work. What do you mean the Kenyan didn't work? I mean, I couldn't get it to the guy. It's still not mine. That's the Chiddush. That even though it doesn't get to him, it gets out of me. Because Kenyan the Rabbanan lo mani the rice is because Hefka Bezen Hefka only works to expropriate, that's upright. Look at the Ksos and the Nesivis. I think it's in Reish Lamed Hey, they discuss this issue. Not for now, that's why I'm not going into it. But that's what some self is for.
The question is that someone has to be right
there.
You can't have a neutral zone. Someone has to own it.
I don't think it's true. Hefka certainly exists as a possibility.
Let me say, I'm not sure. Last year, we said that was that.
We have Kazasa. Yeah, it's true. Yaakov is right. Yaakov is right. If Hefker is us, then what I just told you now is wrong. Oh, if you have some shots in the Machmir, maybe the Machmir hold that Hefker is us, like the Pnei Yeshua suggested. Okay, maybe you're right. I never think of that. Maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. The same Ksos, I think it's, what's it, Kuf Tzadi something? I think it's on the Ravah Kavas. Said maybe Kenyan the Rabbanan won't help the Goyim. Because the Rabbanan and the Goyim, the Rabbanan only made their institutions for Jews, not for non-Jews. That's what he suggests. Of course, against the Ramban, the Feirish. But, no. It's against, he calls it smart all the way. There's a concept called Mechira Shtaris. Have you ever Mechira Shtaris? Sugim Babasra. How do you do it? You do it. Mesira, Ksiva Mesira. I can sell a document to you. So the Mechira Shtaris is Mechira Shtaris is the Rabbanan. The Rabbanan say that way. So the smart said it doesn't work for a guy. So here too by Aga. The Postman says it's an incorrect analogy that Sos made. Mechiras Chomet, Mechiras Shtaris, the entire concept of selling a document any which way doesn't exist by Torah law. The Rachazal said, you know, we were, for the purpose of commerce, of making things easier to buy and sell, we introduced a new concept which the Torah never recognized. What's the concept? You can sell a document. This didn't take the going. But as far as selling a car, I want to sell a car. The Torah says you can sell a car. Sure. The Torah says you can do it with the Shikha, the Torah says you can do it with Kesem, whatever works. That is a new method of selling a car. A new method of selling a car. Different story. A new method of selling a car that they apply to a guy. If the entire concept of selling a shtar doesn't exist by Torah law, they created a new thing. They only created it for what? For Jews. But if we're talking about something where the item can be acquired, sold, and bought, by Torah law. He just wants to add a new method, so then perhaps the new method applies even to a non-Jew. As the Ramban says, clear that Agav works even for Goy. Oh. Now there's some technicalities concerning the Agav. Some technicalities. What if you only rent the land? You don't sell the land. What if you only rent the land and you don't sell it? A very interesting thing. The Ramah says in Siman Reish Beis, Sif Aleph, V'yesh Omrim, Dafilu Akarka Mischiris Umetalt Mimatala, it's good enough. V'yesh Omrim. So the first thing, what? It's an offer to Gemara. It's an offer to Gemara and Kiddushin that it works. They say it's a typo here, but the bottom line, it works for sure. It's a typo. So therefore, if I rent my property to the guy, Mr. Brown, I can actually transfer completely the chametz to Mr. Brown. That's number one. Okay. Number two, what happens if the land does not belong to me? It's only rented to me. Can I still use agav? Yes. So the Ramah says yes. The Ramah over here says in Reish Bay Siv Zion. He says, let me read it to you. V'yachol. Oh, interesting thing. V'yachol lahaknos agav makomo shel beis hakneses. If your only land is your place in shul, that's also good enough. Why? Havikim osholo. As if it's borrowed, lent out to you. You see, Clara from the Ramah, you can, even though you don't own it, you just, it's two steps. The first step was, you own it, but you're only renting it now to Mr. Brown. So then you can still say agav. Second step, you don't own it at all, you're sub-renting it from the landlord. You can still sublease it, and at the same time, you can achieve the goal of king and agav. It's an offer to Ramah. There are those who disagree with the Ramah. But the Ramah says so, and many, many posts can agree with him. Look on the Mechiras Chamsa, gives you a whole list. Why not? There's no difference between selling and renting. I don't know. I don't want to go into it. We pass it, it's good. Now, next problem. The Ramah and Siv Beis that you have to use the Lashon of Agav Ukni. The Machlokas Tos, the famous Machlokas Tos in Ramah and Kedushin. Do you need agav ukni even if only if the chametz is what we call not tziburin, it's not in on top of the karka, or even if it's tziburin, because the mar is a funny lashon. V'ilchasa tziburin lo beina agav ukni beina mon kiddushin. You don't need. I can sell you my house in Riverdale, and agav my house in Riverdale. I can sell you my car in Washington Heights. No problem. Because tziburin lo beina agav ukni. Bina, but to tell you, I got my house here, you can buy my car and wash next. So Sadr Ramam said, oh yeah, whenever it's not Tziburin, then you need Agav Kni. When it is Tziburin, you don't. That's a Mechaber, it's a base. Ramah Paschal the Chumra, no, you always need Agav Kni. The big question means, what does it mean, Agav Kni? What does it mean, Agav? What if you don't use the word Agav, you use the word Im? Yesh Om Debina Dafka Lashon Agav, Aval Im Lo Mahani, V'yesh Cholk. The machlok is today in Ramah. If I don't say the word agav, I say the word if, with. Let's assume the chumra, you have to use the word agav. So what in the world does agav mean? How do you translate the word agav? The fascinating piece here in the Mechiras Chametz Kol Chasov, he quotes that it's very difficult to translate agav into other languages. And for this reason, the Chasam Sofer wrote his Shtar Mechira in German because he didn't know how to translate it in Magyar, in Hungarian. Didn't know how to translate the word Agav. So because of this, he wrote in Hungarian. Excuse me, in German. I looked it up in the back. He has the German. He has the Hebrew letters, but it's
the.
That's right. That's Chasam Sofer himself. That's why he wrote in German. Now I'll read it to you. Anyone here know German? Yiddish? A little bit? Okay. I'm reading to you. It's a page. You don't look it up. It's a page. Shinayin Hay. Contract the Mechiras Chametz. That's how you wrote it. Contract. It's a German word contract, I guess. And this is the Chassam Sofer. It's two places. He has it in page Shin Ayin Aleph and also on Shin Ayin Hey. Both at the same time. He had Shin Ayin Aleph, about last line. Kraft dieser Mietung. No one? What does dieser mean? I should be able to figure out. This. Mietung must mean rental. What does Kraft mean? What is Kraft? Kraft. In English, craft means, you know, lots of crafts, you know. What is craft? On the contrary, in English it means crafty, it means sneaky. You know what craft means in German? Anybody know? Strength. He translates Hebrew, mikoa. Now, I spoke to my lawyer who speaks German. He's a German, I'll tell you my lawyer. My lawyer is Mr. Wippheimer from Nashul, who knows German. I figured he knows German. He knows a little halacha. I better call him. Sure, kraft means force, means power. So that's how you have to translate agav, according to Chassam Sofer. That's why, how do you say that in English? He said, well, maybe by force. That sounds too much, force. So that's how we came up with a new term, which means the same thing. Take a look. This is a new one this year. We used to write, my old document said as follows. In consequence of the sale of the land, you also come to the metal. That's how I used to write. I thought that was a good translation. I got it. That's what I thought. But after Chassam Sofer, we changed it. Look at here, we're up to right now. Dibra Maskel, buy. By dint. Catch that now. By dint. Apparently dint means force. But din is a word which is more commonly used in the legal community. By force, we're a little bit too harsh a term. By reason of. It really means by reason of, but it really means that if you look up in the dictionary, it's by force of, by power of. That's what he wrote. By dint of the execution of this rental agreement, which means kraft, dieser Mietung, the buyer also acquires ownership of all aforementioned described chametz, which is hereby transferred to him in the best legal form. Agav. The word agav is written down also. Agav. Legal form is, of course, Jewish legal form. What do you think it means? Okay, maybe we should say the word Jewish. I don't know.
Jewish words,
foreign
words are
on italics. I don't know. Let's just leave it the way that I think it's okay. That's how we do it. And it's a very nice way to write it. What happens if you say agav? Or must you say agav if you just write it in the document? It's a machlokas. In other words, if I write this in the document, must I say it to him when we go through the agreement? I do it every year. Every single year I make a big tumult about this. We sell it every, because, you know, he's a real estate agent. So we always say, you know, Mr. Brown, we believe the main property in the world is real estate. We like real estate, so forth. Real estate. And, you know, gold, silver, it's also worth something. So we can therefore transfer the movable together with, or by dint, or whatever you want to call it, with the real estate. And that's what we do all the time. That's how we do. Okay. Now that we've finished with agav, any questions? It's important. Every single kid has its own issues.
In they happen the same time.
England?
Im,
yeah. But, okay. The next. Kinyan Chotzer on both sides. We're going on. What do we have so far? What do we have? We had Kesef. We don't do Mashiach. We had Kesef, Chalitin, Situmta, and the Chometz directly. So we had the Schiris. How do we do the Schiris? Kesef, Chalipin, Situmta. And then we mentioned, see, I mentioned to the guy, Rabbi Osai, it's very important. You see, you can't put the cart before the horse in the document. Huh? See, I always tell the guy before we go to the rental that as he's doing these methods of sale on the rental, at that very moment he's acquiring by dint of this this rental agreement, execution. That's why I put the word execution in there. by dint of the execution, I called a maisa. I told Mr. Wimfeld, what's the word for maisa mechira as opposed to chalos mechira? It came with execution. Execution of the rental agreement.
Execution is when this takes effect, not when we do this action.
Speak to the lawyers. The lawyer, he told me, I'm going to execute it as I'm doing it. So that's what we said. Huh? Is that what it means? Right. That means you do execution with mice. So the mice is serious. That, but I couldn't write this. So what should I have done? I should write my execution before. It doesn't make sense in a logical process. Have my execution of this. What this? We haven't spoken about it yet. So the document is written second. But in our oral agreements, which we always say agav before we do the schirus. If you always wake up later, it's too late. So we say it later, but we write it. No. We say it earlier, we write it later. I just want to point this out to you. If you write it earlier in the shtar, I have trouble doing that. I don't think you can find a way how to do it logically. So, okay. Now, we have written down further. By virtue of buyer's rights in these rented storage areas, all chametz contained therein is acquired by the buyer, which we print as chotzer. Chotzer. Chotzer, of course, you know the famous kinyan of chotzer. Ever learned about Metzia, ever? Never? I mean, Baba Metzia, the first paragraph where it comes up primarily. Gittin comes out all over the place. Kinyan chotzer. Major question. We learned chotzer, sure, but we had the chotzer. Midaito, shalom midaito. Problem. Does chotzer work for a non-Jew? Does kinyan chotzer work for a non-Jew or not? It's a serious halachic discussion. So, here's a question. Does it or does it not? So the Rosh says yes. The Mukha Yosef says yes. It's often a Gemara B'Pashtas. And Avodah Zarah. If I out, but yes. The Ramban and the Lamed Aleph says yes. The Rabbeinu David says yes. What's the context over there? The context is a store. Take a look. Let me open the Gemara. Let's open the Gemara so we shouldn't be rusty. Lamed Aleph from the base. You know, it's good that I want to go on just to air it out. You know, think about Metzia. You have to air out the Gemara once in a while. So okay, after the Bechir, we're going back to Gemara. No, we have to get back in here. Lamed Aleph from the base. Sugi here. Tana Rabbanan. Chanus Shel Yisrael. There are two gears actually. Chanus shall nachri, the last few lines before the Mishnah. Umalai shall nachri, Yupoli, Yisrael, Nafas, Yosin, Hashem. Chomet shall nimtzah, Shemachar, Apesel, Mutter, Ba'achila. Well, I think the Rach's gears is more instructive. Look at the gears, Rabbi. We discussed this before, two gears are us. Tana Rabbanan, the Rabbeinu Chananel, the last few narrow lines. Chanus shall nachri, Umalai shall nachri. Chomet shall nimtzah, Apesel, Osin, Ba'anah. Whole discussion is the Nachri Kone and his Chanus. So the Ramban, Rabbeinu David, say over there that the only reason why the Goy is not Kone is because it's not a Chotzer HaMishtameres the Das HaVayla. It's a prerequisite to be Kone B'Chotzer that the Chotzer has to be watchable by the owner. The owner should have some measure of oversight of the property. It has to be chotzer hamishtameres ledas balam. It has to be watched with the knowledge of the owner. But apparently over here, in this case of the chanus, it's not mishtameres ledas balam. That's the Rabbi David and the Ramban both say ledas. Otherwise, it would be kohen. You see, clear from the Emet, from the Rosh, Rabbeinu Yosef, four gedolei rishonim say that there exists a kinyan chotzer for a goy. That's four gedolei. The Rosh, the Mukha Yosef, Rabbeinu David, and the Ramban, and the Rabbi Rutenbrook is the same way. Gedolei Yisrael, all the Gedolei Rishonim say. Fine. The Meiri disagrees. The Meiri says, no good. Doesn't work. But by the way, I was just wondering a little bit. Even assuming the Chatzah works, are all of our properties called Mishtameres Adas HaGoy? I sell John Brown the Chametz in my linen closet. Is that linen closet called Mishtameres Adas John Brown? I mean, I'm watching the chametz, not John Brown. I'm watching the Adas. I'm in charge of my closets. I have to look carefully in the halakha of the Mishtamar. What does it mean, the Mishtamar, the Daz Bar? Yeah. I have to look into it. I don't know. I'm just making it. I didn't see the possible to raise this issue, but the Chorus is a serious issue. Now, let's go on. The Meiri is probably based on a very simple Gemara in Baba Metzia, which you should have learned sometime, or you must have heard about it. How does Chatzah work? I don't know. What's Chatzah? How does it work? What's the lumbus of Chatzah? Gemara suggests Yad, but also suggests what else? Shlichus. The Sugya of Baba Metzia. Is Chatzah mitam Yad or mitam Shlichus? Chatzah works mitam Shlichus. It's an obvious problem. What's that? Come on, wake up. Hey, Shlichus the Nachri. That's a serious problem. So how is the chatzah going to work for a guy? That's the issue over here. That's probably the reason for the Meiri. You look above Matiya Daf Yud Aleph, you see that whole discussion. It says, yep, the Mishlichus. But the Gemara says in that same Daf Yud Aleph that if the person is standing right next to the chatzah, then it works with Torah's Yad. Well, it's just like your hand is near your body. Famous the Gemara. Your hand is near your body. They wouldn't want to get divorced. So as the Beferish Mishnah, if you throw the get into her yard and she's standing nearby and she's divorced, why? Chatzah for her works mitam yad, but only she's standing nearby, because it's like her hands near her body, so the chatzah should be near her body too. That's a gemara by Matir that you know. So therefore, this basis, I have to look at the Machzor Shekel, where he says that there's some rabbanim who prefer selling the chametz to a non-Jewish woman. Why? Because they feel that the whole din of chatzah working with the yad only comes from a woman, and we derive from gittin. So too, the non-Jewish woman is the only one who can acquire chametz, not a non-Jewish man. The Machzor Shekel Beferish on top memches, sitkot and base, right there. I don't understand that frankly at all, because today we don't have the guy standing there all the chatzers. So the girls are like a sibuf and run around every chatzah and the mechira's chametz form. I don't think the whole thing is true. By the way, the discussion, what if she's married? I played my first year with a non-Jewish woman. She was married. Some say it doesn't work if she's married. Why? Masha kanta isha kana vayla. The question that applies to goyim or not. Interesting question. Again, all these are not for now. If you look in the mechira's chametz, on the chatzah, they discuss all these issues. There's an often a gemara that it works. The one about a zarat of ayin aleph. What does it say over there? The Gemara says that there's a principle called Kalev Shalkona, that if I have a utensil, I have a bucket, and you throw gold into my bucket, I can be called to the gold with Kinyan Chatzah. And the Gemara says Beferish that it works for good. So the Makor Chaim says right over here, it's a, what are you pilpling so much? It's an off in the Gemara, black on white, that you can have Mechiras Chametz to a guy with Kinyan Chatzah, but Farish and Gemara, you can't deny Gemara. You'll ask me a kasha. Chatzah is mitam shlichus. No. So the Pefarshim is a kasha. So the Marit Al Ghazi, have you heard of him? The Rabbi Al Ghazi now in Queens. Yeah. He probably sent to the Marit Al Ghazi. He's a famous parish of which Mesechta, anyone know? Called famous of Mesechta Bechoros. Ramban Zichos Bechoros is a famous on the side, Marit Al Ghazi. He says, you know why it works? Interesting thing, he says, a big chiddush. He says, when they say Ein Shlichus L'Nachri, it's only because a Jew can't make a Goyish Shliach, nor can a Goy make a Jewish Shliach. But a Goy can make a Goyish Shliach. Ma'ata b'nei bris, Tafshin Chachra b'nei bris. Yeah, but the Goy is not a b'nei bris, nor is a Shliach. Over here too, the Chatzir is a Shliach for the Goy. The Chatzir is not Jewish, and the Goy is not Jewish.
Who works for Jews?
Like a guy.
He
does
Kinyan Chatzah by a Jew. Two Jews.
No.
So we don't say
that
Chatzah
by
a guy.
Oh. Like a dog. Whatever it may be, the Chatzah is not inanimate, I guess. I don't know what to say. That's what the Marital Gazi suggests. The Ktsos said a different verb. Look, he says, just like, the Shliach Ben Bris, because as you said, Avram, the Chatzah is not Jewish, so to the Mishaleach is also not to be a Ben Bris. It's an exception to the rule. So the Ktos suggests in Kuf Sadi Dal. Others disagree. But it's hard enough to arrive in the Gemara. Because Sameach and the Mechira Perakav talks about this raya. Is it good? Is it not good? Because he suggests, the Rambam says that Kalev is not midin chotzer, but it's midin hakbo. But if you look at the Shvive Eish in the back, that's not true. I don't know if the Kli is in his hand. The Kli is on the floor, then it works midin chotzer. That's what we're doing in the lesson of the Rambam. So therefore, we assume Rov Poskim assume that chotzer works for a male, for a female. Whether you're there, Sad today, now for today. My biggest question about chotzer is the question of Mishtamer and Tadas Habayim. That's what bothers me a little bit about it. Yes? Not necessarily. So that's what we put in our provisions. It's very important. The Mechiras Chametz points out that although Agav works at the same time as the rental, Chametz works afterwards. That's the post we say. Conceptually, it works in 2 separate seconds. 1 second you rent the property, and only later, the next second, the Shachas and Siman Reish Beis, only subsequently are you Kona B'chot. That's what you got over here. Further, by virtue of buyer's rights and all rent historians, this is not the Maisa. It's because of the rights. The rights come afterwards. After, it has rights. So then we say it's Kona B'kinyan Chot. That's what we write. Yes or no? Well, we're afraid that one work works, not the other one. We don't know which works. Sometimes Agam doesn't work. Agam is the Rabbona. This is the Raisa for sure. Works for Gittin. Right? Some say Chaz doesn't work for a guy. But Agav does work for a guy. Not Mitam Shlichus. Every Kenyan in the book, someone says doesn't work. Let's run down the list. Some say Chaz doesn't work. We just saw that. Maybe he says, because we didn't Chaz, didn't Shlichus. Some say Agav doesn't work for Goyim at all. Rabban doesn't work for Goyim. No Mepharish where it works for Agav. Right. Some say Ketz doesn't work. Because it's Ketzav work by Torah Vos Konas for a Jew and for Goyin and Mashiach. That's how. What else do we have? Situmta. Chalipin. What about them? So the Dov of Erevava here and Tav Mem Ches says, hey, Gevalt, how come nobody uses Chalipin for Mechiras Chametz? That's the best Kenyan of all. Let's use Chalipin. Rabbi Tam writes with Feirish in Tos Kiddushin of Gimel that it works for a Goy Chalipin. So let's use that. So the Gagal Rav says, you know, there's one person standing in my way. It's the Shach. The Shach writes in Kof Gimel, so Kof Lamed, that it doesn't work. You know why? What's the proof it doesn't work? You know what his proof is? You're not going to believe it. His proof, that's what some say. It says there's also a Tzu to be Yisroel. He has a different proof. How come no one says about Mechiras Chametz? Shach. You should only have looked in the Dagon Ravava, what came 100 years later. The Shach brings a riot from the fact that the Rishonim, or those who came before him, didn't mention Khalifa and that it doesn't work. And Dagon says, it still works, it's the best thing of all. Enough for the Tarsic Kedushin of Gimel. But nevertheless, although Tos says it works, the Machlok, the Shach says it doesn't work. Some say it's the Rabbanan. The Rabbanan don't help with the Raisin. That's what the Post can go into this whole story again. Khalifa might be the Rabbanan. Yes?
What is that? Why
does the Shach say the reason? I guess he says Israel. It was also a tzud of Israel. Shalaf Ishnala. It's also the fun of Israel. A gul of Alatmura.
So it's a guy and Jew. So it can't be two
Khalifan.
It has to be the
two Jews. Either doesn't work at all, the Shach, or all the Rabbana. Won't work for our purpose. That's what the others suggest. Yes.
So far, according to what you've said, we have done 5 Kenyan. Kesef, Sefer, Situmta, Agav, and Chotzer.
Well, let's get the Situmta now. 1 second.
So why do we go through all this?
I told you. Each and every one is controversial.
Everything's a shallow.
Right.
So everything we do also in our life is a shallow too. Is there
right.
A sock for any of these things?
No.
It sounds like a whole batch of Chumras right here.
Right.
I have everything.
Right. So since we're not sure, and Chumras is very serious now, we try to do the best we can. Despite that, we still try to do the best we can. There's one Kenyan I don't do. One kid that I refuse to do. No, I can't do it. I don't want to do it. I can't do that. There's one kid I refuse to do. I used to do it. It's written in some of the traditional forms. I refuse to do it. That's called Kenyan Odisa. You know, this sugya means I admit that something is yours, it becomes yours. So why don't I do it? I'll tell you why. In my opinion, that only works for the owner himself. I admit that all my balabatim's chametz belongs to John Brown. The rabbi's trying to get even with the balabatim. How can I admit that someone else's chametz is not yours? So the Mechiras Chavetz book, Perek Yudal HaOretz, Yesh Amrim, some say, quotes from somebody or other, that Odisa will not work. And that's why everyone disagrees. I don't see how you can possibly disagree. That's why I don't do it. I don't do it. So I'll leave one kidding out. But see, Tumta, I do do. I shake hands. And I must confess and cover it up. Even when I used to do the first 2 years with a woman, I still shook her hand. It was in the Giyah Shalom V'Derechiva. And it was necessary for purposes of Mechiras Chavetz. I'll be a big tzaddik. I'm not going to shake a hand, and as a result of that, I'm causing a shash in the Mechiras Chavetz. A glove. Yeah?
It's not hitting himself on
the glove. Right, it's not hitting himself on the glove. Yeah. See, Tumta is a formalized kinyan. Hula Bab Matsiya here. That Ayin Dalat is where it comes from, the Sugya. Whatever you do a kinyan, which is the normal Minig HaSochim, that is called like a diamond. You know what? You don't know what the Sugya is like diamonds? No, they never shake hands. Two words. Mazel Brach. You say the words Mazel Brach on 47th Street, if you're Jewish or Goyish, whoever you are. Say Mazel Bracha, that's it. You back out after that, you're a pariah, you're completely knocked out of the That's it. Those are that's the minute. Mazel Bracha, that's it. You don't want to sell, so don't say Mazel Bracha yet. Once those two words are said by the both parties, Mazel Bracha, that's it. Finish. That's it. So here too, shaking hands in many circles. I don't know if they use it for diamonds, shaking hands. I'm not sure. I don't remember if they do it. But other places, you know, once you shake your hand, that's it. I mean, you shake your hand, you gave your hand, you gave your shook your hand. Your word, word is always difficult to play with words. You shake hands, he has cop, that's already a more formalized action, yes.
Not everybody has a formalized action. Why not just make it a legally binding contract?
This is legally binding. I mentioned already yesterday that there's some poskim who say that this shtar can work not only for the karka but even for the metaltlin. Why? Why? The Torah see tumta. I mentioned it yesterday. The Torah see tumta. Some say see tumta is the rabbanon. Oh, here we go again. And if it's the rabbanon again, some say it's not going to work. Some say it's the oraisa. So we assume that perhaps it works. What happens if you use dina de machusa dina? Not tzitumta, not a minig of the private people, but it's legally binding in court. I have a fancy lawyer, and if the lawyer tells me that this is going to hold up in court for dina de machusa, will that work for mechiras chametz? So again, the machlokas again is dina de machusa in the d'oraisa de rabbanon. What's the machlokas of Beis Shmuel with Avne Meluim and Simon Chavches? And of course, once again, if it's the rabbanon, it may still work with the chasam sefer, the chasam sefer we had before. Right, because it's a hefker, right? The whole story. Now, here's a good question. What if it works for Bosai, it did Torah, but it wouldn't work at Dina de Machus? Here's a serious question. If it would work, it did Torah, but let's say a lawyer would say it's not going to work. But it did Torah, it would work. Mahadin. If the Mechiras Chametz valid or invalid, the Chasam Sofer and the Baruch Tam say, no good. No good. You better make sure that your lawyer says, this is good. Because if it's no good in the lawyer's terms, even though in the Dini Torah it's perfectly good, it's still no good for Mechiras Chametz. Because you deal with a guy. The guy will go to court, and the court invalidated, and you're out of luck, so the Mechiras ends up being yours. I and the Torah would be different, but the guy has the right to go to court. So it better be good in Dini and Malchus also. Writes the Chasam Sofer and the Baruch Tam. Well, the Baruch Tam's Edom, the Rechayim, said the Shver is wrong. The Rechaim was all quoted from the Mechiras Chametz. So the Rechaim said if it's binding in Dinei HaTorah, even though it's not Chal in Dinei de Machusa, it doesn't make a difference. And we try, of course, but it doesn't make a difference. One final thing for today. Here. Everyone, the rest of the form we already read, no? It's further agreed that the right access, keys, we already discussed this already. State of New York, State of the Torah, one thing. What happens if somebody appoints me, and I, instead of signing with the guy myself, I appoint somebody else? I'm too lazy to come. So I'll go to Rabbi Rosenblatt and say, Rabbi Rosenblatt, do me a favor. I'll give you all my documents, and I'm appointing you. So on the east side, Rabbi Sif told me, that's how they did it. Both Rav Henkin, Zichron Aruch, and Rav Moshe, in with the Gedolim, each one in his time. So everybody, Zion different shuls, still they wrote them. We appointed Rabbi Siv, and Rabbi Singer, and Rabbi this, and that, and that. And then they appointed Rabbi Moshe, and Rabbi Henkin before him, to sell the Chavos to a guy. I don't like it. I don't understand why they did it that way. I don't understand. The big machlokas, shliach also shliach, and shliach also shliach. Some say only if you sign a document, but otherwise not. It's a long story. We learned Gittin, we spoke about this. That was, how many years ago was that? Who was here for Gittin?
4 years
ago. No one was here for that one. So we learned Gittin, we spoke about that. It's a barichas gedola. Not so posh. I don't know why you got involved, Mr. Shabbos.
You don't know the deed, to do the wholesale in the first place.
Right, that's the problem. The problem is the rabbi ratzim.
They just didn't learn it that well. They're afraid to do it.
Okay. So they didn't know how to do it. So they went to Rav Moshe and to Rav Henkin. I don't like to do it. We try to get every rabbi to do it. And they just do it the same way. And that's how we do it. We're going to have to discuss tomorrow a number of important things after we finish with Mr. Brown. One, can I appoint, while I'm doing speaking, could you please sign this thing? There's a sign out sheet here. You have to sign. Please. One. Just pass around. One. If I sign my power of attorney 2 weeks before Pesach, Rosh Chodesh Nissan, and I buy new chametz on the fifth day of Nissan, can the rabbi sell it to me? Or should we say no? When I appointed him, I was a davar shelo b'olam. I didn't own it yet. That's shaila number one. Shaila number two is, what are you doing on Erev Pesach Shacharis B'Shabbos? Do we sell it effective immediately? Do we sell it effective 1 minute before Shabbos, so that it should be more clear what's coming and what's going? Or do we sell it effective on Shabbos? Who was here when we learned Masechta Beitza? That we had some people from Beitza. We had a whole discussion with Rabbi Kivager. Can you do an act of Kenyan on Friday when its validity begins on Shabbos? I thought that most posts may say it's actually Mutter, though some disagree. Right? From Rishalmi, we'll discuss what the various options are tomorrow. But both remember, 10:30 tomorrow, because of Mr. Brown. Okay?
Good. Mr. Brown, although I think everyone in the room is familiar with it, but Jewish law prevents us, prohibits us, I should say, from owning any chametz on the Passover holiday. Now, there are a number of options. One option is simply to burn or to otherwise eliminate any chametz which you may own. Another option, which we find Talmudic sources for, we discussed already in detail, is that the chametz be sold to someone who's not Jewish. Of course, someone who's not Jewish is permitted to own the chametz on the Passover holiday. And the Jew who sold the chametz to the non-Jew was not in violation of this prohibition of owning chametz on Passover. And, as we learned based on the Talmudic sources, even more than that, it's permissible that after the Passover holiday is over, that the non-Jew sell the exact same chametz back to the Jewish person. And we saw the Talmudic sources, what we call a Tosefta, which is an early Talmudic source, goes back thousands of years, and that's where the beginnings of this practice are. And we have discussed over the last week or more many of the problems which have been raised concerning this sale. And I've told my students, Mr. Brown, that I feel myself very fortunate that a man such as yourself has resides in or works in our community, and we're able to do business with you, as we've been doing for the last 18 or 19 years, I believe. And every year we wish Mr. Brown well. There's something which we did not discuss this past week, which is that 1 year Mr. Brown raised a very terrifying question. And he said, Rabbi, we all like to hope that we're going to be healthy and we'll be well and everything like that, but what if, God forbid, in the middle of a Passover, the party, I think Mr. Brown used the word that he would, quote, expire, end quote. I mean, we wish him well, and I said, well, John, we wish you many happy and healthy years. And I told him that, the law of averages would have it, that this has happened in the Jewish history in Europe somewhere in the past, and there's a volume which I left in my office called Stei Chemet, which discusses this very case, a very serious halachic question. I should say that it also happens in the other direction, where a Jewish individual
who has sold the chametz to a non-Jewish person. That we did discuss a little bit. And then the person passes away while the chametz has been, already been sold. I had the case this past year. Aside from my dealings with Mr. Brown, I had to do a couple of private deals with people who have their own non-Jewish help in the home, etc. And one of my main clients in that type was Mr. Jessison, blessed memory. He sold his chametz to the non-Jewish woman in his, who works as a domestic help in his house. As you probably know, he went to Israel and he passed away, although it was just before the Passover holiday, but it was already after the sale had been done. And the family returned. We discussed, after the other more weighty matters, it was brought up that, yes, Mary Murphy, who was the woman who owned all the chametz, remembered that the chametz was all hers, and then after the Passover holiday was over, she transferred it back to the children, to the wife. So there is literature about these things, but we always say that we wish Mr. Brown well, both on Passover, after Passover, for many years. And the fact that Mr. Brown has been kind enough to do this business with us is, I consider it a kindness, not because there are not other individuals who are of non-Jewish faith with whom we can deal. Mr. Brown is almost uniquely qualified as a perfect businessman to do this deal with us, and that's why I asked him to come so we can talk to you about it. We're going to go through a mock sale just to show that how we do it in terms of the sale. But more than that, there are those, as I'm just repeating that what we discussed in past days, there are those who have quibbles with the sale on the grounds that the person who is buying the chametz is not a business person. It doesn't know what it means to buy something. It doesn't know what it means to have a down payment. It doesn't know what it means to have a remainder of a loan. The remainder being a loan, the non-payment of which should only affect the sale. And sometimes there's a person who's not Jewish who simply has no money. And therefore, you're selling it for X dollars and you know you can't come up with any of the money. So then even that somehow makes the sale a bit weaker. Now, we didn't, of course, never measure Mr. Brown's net worth. Although we wish you well on that score, certainly we want you to be healthy and wealthy and wise. But since Mr. Brown has been a successful real estate broker for many years in our community, so we feel that at least some money he has, we hope, accumulated. And although in our past dealings, it's never really been a problem because Mr. Brown, as he will demonstrate soon, never really felt quite ready to pay off all these outstanding debts. But still the fact that there's that possibility exists to some point is a significant matter. Moreover, by being in the real estate area and having known what most of the houses in Riverdale look like, either having been inside them or been around them, he's even better able to know exactly where the chametz is found. The person writes a document, I have it in this house, in this address, in this place. Mr. Brown has either been actually seen the place or seen around the place. And this is also a very significant plus. So a lot of very significant qualities merge in Mr. Brown, and that's why we're very happy to have him as our business partner, if you perhaps try to answer them. If you have any questions about the mindset or about the attitude about the sale, you can ask if you want. Don't be ashamed. Yes?
Do you ever, like, ever want to go into